I'm expecting that I'm going to pause at 11 o'clock because it is Remembrance Day. At the same time, after the moment of silence, I'll probably continue just, as I've done the previous weeks, just to be available for questions and comments, because there's a lot to talk about. We're trying to fit in a lot today. I also want to make sure you saw the email that I sent out the other day with the flyer for the next series. God willing, that series will be December 2nd, 9th, and 16th, The Kabbalists of Tzfat. It's going to be a lot of fun. It will be a blend of history and philosophy, so biography of three leading figures from 16th century Tzfat and their impact and what their ideas are, their philosophies. That should be interesting. A little bit of something for everybody. As I said before we started, the topic for this morning is particularly appropriate for Remembrance Day. We're going to be talking about vaccine trials and the topic of endangering oneself in order to help others. And obviously, Remembrance Day, we're thinking about soldiers, we're thinking about those who fell, who actually gave their lives, and in doing so, provided life as well as freedom for so many others. So I think this topic really fits very well. And yes, I have my poppy, but you can't really see it because of where the monitor is, but now you can see it. I think that's especially important within the Jewish community, which benefited so much in various ways from those who fought and fell. The session today is dedicated with the following gifts from the Day of Giving that my Beit Midrash held back in July, from Joseph and Yocheved Zeifman, Moshe and Nicole Posner, and Rabbi Ezra and Alyssa Goldschmidt. So thank you to all of you. The main topic for this morning is indeed vaccine trials and challenge trials. And so what I wanted to do is just begin first by explaining what those are. There are different kinds, and it causes some degree of confusion. So let's see if we can get this. Rochelle, I'm seeing two of you on the screen here. This is great. This is good. Sign on again. It's entertaining. I'm not sure what would happen if I would unmute one. Would the other one also be on? I don't know. This is a quantum problem. Okay. So I gave you links on the sheet to a few articles about vaccine trials and specifically challenge trials, which are a subset. But here's the deal. When they want to set up trials for vaccines, the first step is they do initial safety trials. They want to just make sure that to the best extent that possible, they can determine that the vaccine is not going to cause harmful effects or is going to have minimal harmful effects. Sometimes they accept a harmful effect because it's justified for the benefit of vaccination. They will also work on vaccine dosage, trying to figure out what's an appropriate dose, what's a necessary dose, and usually they come up with some kind of a range. They test immunogenicity, meaning does the vaccine provoke the desired immune response. They try to do this, sort of preliminarily, before injecting it into people. They try to do different things to test it, just to establish a basic level of safety and efficacy. And then they need to go into human beings in stages of trials. And they try to use candidates who are at low risk for complications, low risk certainly for harm. At the same time, they want candidates who are from a population that is going to be exposed to the virus in the course of normal activity. That's not in a challenge trial. That's in a regular trial. So in other words, they're injecting the vaccine into people who live in cities just like Toronto, places where the virus is already found out in society, and there are two reasons for them to do that. Number one, you want to take people who are going to be exposed to the virus anyway in society for ethical reasons, because you don't want to endanger somebody who is otherwise safe. Right? You're taking somebody who lived in a place where they were not likely to encounter the virus, and now you're going to inject them with a vaccine and that's going to potentially harm them. Let me restate that, because I think that I said that in a way that's more complicated than it needs to be. When you take candidates for a vaccine trial, you're taking them for two possible kinds of trials. I think this is a clearer way for me to frame it. One type of trial is a trial in which you're going to inject them with the vaccine and then release them out into the world. They will, in the course of normal interaction, come across the virus, because people do. And the test is, will they develop immunity such that those who received the vaccine have lower rates of infection than the people around them? That's one kind of trial. So you're giving them the vaccine, they act and interact the way everybody else does. You don't tell them to put themselves at greater risk than other people. And you see, within society, I'm just making up numbers, 2% of people get sick. However, within this group, nobody gets sick, or, you know, 0.5% or whatever it is. So that determines that the vaccine had some effect broadly. That's one type of trial. Everyone clear on that? You follow? Okay. That's one kind of trial. Then you have a second kind of trial, and that's what we call a challenge trial. And in a challenge trial, what they actually do is they inject the candidates with the vaccine. You also have a population that's getting a placebo, that's important to note. And you then actually expose them to the virus. So it's not just, now go about your business, and we'll see whether your infection rate is better or worse than that of others, but we're actually actively exposing them to the virus and seeing whether the people who got the placebo get sicker than those who got the vaccine. You follow? So in your first kind, they are just living life normally. In your second kind, they are actively exposed to the virus, and that includes the people who are getting the placebo are going to be actively exposed to the virus. And that's what I meant. Susan, I see your hand. That's what I meant when I said that you want to choose people who are from communities where they would be exposed to the virus anyway, when you're talking about the challenge trial. Because it's really unethical to take somebody who would have had minimal to no exposure, and now you're actively going to give them the virus. And if they're in the placebo group, you know, odds are pretty high they're going to get infected. This is a highly contagious virus when we're talking about COVID. So that's the second kind of trial. Yes, Susan?
Does the first group also have a placebo?
So placebo, you mean in the regular trials?
Yeah.
So I believe they do, actually. It's less significant because the whole community there is effectively the placebo group also, but they're less controlled. So I think you do also use a placebo group for the sake of control. But that's the idea. I see what you wrote to me in the chat, Mark. I'm getting to that. Thank you for the note. So what you're doing here is in the challenge trial, exposing people to the virus, and specifically to a dose of the virus that is significant enough that it should produce a clinical response, but that is not more severe than would have happened naturally in the community. In other words, you're trying, to the extent possible, from an ethical perspective, to avoid exposing them to a greater than necessary risk. So why expose them to great levels of the virus? Expose them to the level that people would encounter normally in the community. So the ethical difference between this and regular trials is very clear, right? It's like the case that we've discussed on other occasions, the story in the Jerusalem Talmud about a caravan that's surrounded by attackers. And the attackers say, listen, hand over so-and-so to us, or we kill everybody, right? And then the question is, what if they don't say hand over so-and-so? They say hand over somebody to us. or else we kill everybody. So on the one hand, you might argue, well, it's better to hand over one person, and that person's going to die anyway because they're going to attack and kill everybody. But on the other hand, who am I to choose which person is going to get handed over? What a grotesque thing to do, to make a decision like that. But that's what we're doing here, is we're picking people. Now, we're not picking people because they volunteer. This isn't a society where you can force people to do it. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But we're deciding who is going to be exposed to harm for the sake of everybody else. So this is a very dangerous thing from an ethical perspective. We're going to talk about some of the justifications for it, but I wanted to show you source number one. Lest you say, well, nobody would actually do this, that you wouldn't actually engage in such trials in which you actively expose people to the virus. Here's an article from the journal Nature from, as you see, August 20th. Dozens to be deliberately infected with coronavirus in UK human challenge trials. Young healthy people will be intentionally exposed to the virus responsible for COVID-19 in a first of its kind human challenge trial. The UK government and a company that runs such studies announced on the 20th of October. So I must have written 8 and meant 10. That's interesting. I was thinking 8 from October. I don't know. But yeah, that's not 8/20. That's 10/20. That was October 20th. The experiment set to begin in January in a London hospital if it receives final regulatory and ethical approval aims to accelerate the development of vaccines that could end the epidemic. Human challenge trials have a history of providing insight into diseases such as malaria and influenza, so this isn't the first go-round for this kind of a trial. The UK trial will try to identify a suitable dose of the SARS-CoV virus that could be used in future vaccine trials. But the prospect of deliberately infecting people, even those at low risk of severe disease, with COVID-19, a deadly pathogen that is, well, it's really the SARS-CoV virus, a deadly pathogen that has few proven treatments, is uncharted medical and bioethical territory. That's what we're talking about, and as you see, it's actually good to go. The truth of the matter is that the timing in the article is interesting. They say that the trial is set to begin in January. I wonder, at what point, after how many effective viruses have already passed trials, do you say, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to run this anymore? And we heard the Pfizer news about 90% efficacy. So obviously you still have to work through the data and you don't know how long the effect is going to last and so on. But imagine if you volunteered for this back in the summertime and then by January you hear news of 3 or 4 vaccines that have already reached a very strong threshold and that are going to be going into circulation. Are you still eager to take this, to participate in this trial? I wonder a little bit about that. But in any case, this is a thing, this kind of a challenge trial. And the way they do it is they actually stagger groups for this. So in other words, already people who are entering into a vaccine challenge trial are putting themselves in harm's way. But there's a structure within that group. So some people are at even greater risk, specifically those in the first batch. So in other words, if they have 10,000 people who are going to be in the study, so they may take them and infect them in batches of 1,000 and stagger it so that you have one batch, then 2 weeks later another group, 2 weeks later another group, so that you can see the effects on the first people before you start to expose more people. Now, clearly what you do when you're going to run such a trial is you take people who are naturally healthy. In other words, you don't want people who are already vulnerable to a point where you could really be pushing them over the edge by giving them this virus. Even though you want the vaccine to work for everybody, including people with certain health problems, nonetheless, you don't want to put them in a challenge trial. You also make sure that the people who are in the trial get priority for the best possible care and the best resources. Because again, the people who are, hang on, Marla, the people in the placebo group like have a very strong chance of developing the virus, you want to know that they're going to get the best care possible and be in the best position to survive it. Marilyn, you were going to say?
I just want to ask, they're not aware of what they're getting, is that right?
That is correct. They do not know whether they're getting vaccine or placebo. That's correct. To know what they're getting would damage the trial itself. So that's correct. They're not aware. I'm just putting the link for the sheet in the chat because some people have joined and I want to make sure they get it. So that's what we're talking about. Susan, yeah.
I've heard on news programs where they've interviewed people from who are taking the trial and they ask them why they're doing it. It's the first question everybody seems to be asked. And each person that I've seen who's been asked, all say they feel it's their duty to save, to help society. I have children, or my cousin has children, or somebody, and I want to make sure the world is safe. Like, they're going in totally understanding.
Yes.
It's like they know they've been briefed on everything from the way it sounded.
Right, so that's actually...
They have a good motive.
Right. So that's actually what I want to come to next here, is the justifications for doing this. Why is it okay if you have a trial of 10,000 people, and let's pretend it's 50-50 for the placebo. I don't know that it is. But let's pretend that 5,000 people are getting the placebo. 5,000 people are going to be directly infected with a virus. Why is this okay? What would you say? What's the justification? Right. So one answer is they volunteer and we get specifically their consent. It's supposed to be informed consent. I want to come back to informed consent later because informed consent is a lot more complicated than people realize. There are a lot of complications in giving informed consent, but it's true. They volunteer and thanks to the media, they all know how serious infection can be. So they know going in, but that's not really justification. Right? If somebody walks up to me in the street and says, punch me in the face, they are giving informed consent. I'm still not allowed to do that.
Is it the good of the group versus the good of singular people?
Right. So the answer could be, as Susan says, this is something that society needs. Right? We have other people like this. We have other positions like this, not in the time of a virus. Rosalind, you were going to say?
So I think with all diseases, that's how they make progress, is with these trials. They certainly do it with cancer care, and that's how they go step by step to find cures or find treatments that work. I think it's a practiced way of making progress, even though it sounds brutal.
Right, well, the difference is that in, let's say, a cancer trial, you're taking people who already have the disease and trying something out. Here, the analogy to a cancer trial would be if we would take people and blow cigarette smoke into their lungs for a period of time and then give them treatments and say, hey, did the treatment stop them from developing cancer? And by the way, some people are going to get the cigarette smoke and and they're just going to get a placebo and see if they develop cancer. It's, in other words, what's difficult about this is not just the point about trying something that may not work, but it's about actively giving people the disease, knowing there are 50% of the people or whatever percentage it is have no protection. That's the, you know, that's the problem here. Sarah, you were going to say?
Yeah.
Okay. Sandy and then Moish.
With these trials, a lot of the people that volunteer, as Susan said, they're young, they volunteer. From what I've read and seen, a lot of them are on the front line. They do know what they're dealing with. And I think they went into the profession to save people, and seeing how people suffer with this, and that they're exposed to it anyway,
mm-hmm.
they feel like you can commit them to trying to change it.
So, I mean, that may be their motivation, but I'm talking about why it's okay for society. Moish, did you raise your hand by accident or on purpose?
Back in the time of the rabbis, the term was called a good Samaritan, although not by the Jews. But now, the term is called citizen. I am part of a society, and it's not a matter of a duty, not a matter of a sacrifice. This is my moral contribution to a society. You don't have to call it moral. You can call it anything you want. But this is how, it's actually the same thing as an individual who will step in front of a bus to save a child from being run over on the street.
So again, this is all well and good in terms of their motivation. I'm talking about it from the perspective of society and why it's okay for society to do this. What's the justification? Brenda, I see your hand. I'm just going to address two comments that people have sent me directly in the chat. Number one, someone asked about Russia, where there were, you know, it was reported that they did this in the military. I don't know anything about the results in Russia or China, where I heard similar things. Someone else made a point about financial inducement for the subjects. So I think ethically they're not allowed to provide financial inducement for it. But yes, that would raise questions certainly in terms of the ethics of it. So Brenda and then Mark. Yeah. You're muted, Brenda. So there are some level of animal trials. I'm not sure of the extent of it, just in terms of whether it really translates onto the human level and therefore how much use they are. But they do initial safety trials and I think also immunogenicity trials to see whether the vaccine triggers an immune response. I think they try them in animals first. I'm not enough of an expert to say that definitively. There are certainly safety trials that are running first on whatever level that can be done before this goes into a human being. Mark.
Okay, I would think that would make a difference for the person who's volunteering if they know that it's got to be untrial.
Yeah, no, that's for sure true. Yeah, Mark.
There is a risk. However, society does as much as possible to minimize the risk. First of all, they're taken from a low-risk, healthy group. Secondly, they're being monitored throughout. They're not just being saying, so long, Charlie, we'll see what happens if you keel over. And also, even people who get COVID, most of them will not develop a very life threatening illness. So there is a risk, but society does everything possible to minimize the risk.
Good. So that's correct. The some of the justifications are that we minimize the risk of harm, we give them good care, we use people whose vulnerability is low. That's for sure included in it. We mentioned already informed consent. We also use people who are likely to be exposed anyway in the community so that we're adding less to their risk. But the other thing is we do this all the time outside of the vaccine trial setting. We recruit firefighters, right? You recruit firefighters even in California during a time when you know they're going to be exposed to danger. We recruit EMS workers during a pandemic, knowing full well that they're going to be exposed. So it's not as though this is unique. It is more dramatic than seen elsewhere. But we do, as a society, put people in harm's way. Mark, I saw that you unmuted, but I also see that it's 10:24. So I'm going to go further here. We haven't even entered the Jewish aspect of it. Right now, we've just defined what we're talking about. There are challenges in response to this. You know, in those opening articles that I gave you on the sheet, the bullet-pointed ones, when the initial article on that list promotes challenge studies, there's a response that says the fact that we have had other medical trials and used volunteers for other medical trials does not necessarily mean that this is okay. Maybe it's wrong to do it in other settings as well. Would we consider, I mentioned the case of you mentioned the case of the cancer study, would it really be ethical to say, you know what, let's take a population that is subject to risk. Let's say we take people who work in the mines, okay? Or let's say we take people who work in other environments that, Rose, I put the link in the chat. Look in the chat and you'll be able to get it. Let's say you took people who work in environments that have carcinogens, and let's inject them with carcinogens and also with a cancer vaccine that we're working on and see if it helps them. The argument that, well, it's for the sake of society is a hard argument to make, because utilitarian morality is very difficult to apply in the realm of medicine, right? Saying that, yes, we're going to endanger one person in order to be able to help others, that can lead us in all sorts of dangerous directions ethically. How far down that line do you go, right? Consider eugenics from 120 years ago, right? In Germany as well as in North America. The idea that, well, we should say that certain people are not entitled to breed because their children will have traits that are not good for society, and society will have to support them and so on. Like, if I'm willing to say, let individuals, be harmed for the sake of the many, that can take us in some very dangerous directions. So what I want to do now is talk this through from the perspective of Jewish ethics and Jewish law. Not weighing in on the science of this method, not weighing in on the safety of this method. But what would Jewish law have to say in general? It's very interesting. In the early days of heart transplants, right, going back to the 60s and 70s, in the early days of kidney transplants, there was a lot of opposition from authorities in Jewish law to engaging in those, saying that the chances of success were very low and the chances of harm were very high. I mentioned last week that opposition to kidney donation has really faded, and really to the point where in Israel today, donating a kidney in the observant community, in the Torah observant community, is considered a badge of honor. To the point where somebody in Israel actually told me that it's considered to be a plus for a shidduch, to be able to marry off if someone in the family has donated a kidney. It's considered to be a sign of positive character. But let's see what we can say here. So first, we talk self-endangerment for the sake of achieving a benefit. We already know, we've talked about at length, the fact that in Judaism, risky activity is prohibited, right? We spent a lot of time talking that through. However, we've also said that self-endangerment for the sake of personal gain is potentially justified. And there is personal gain if the vaccine works, right? I benefit directly, my family benefits, and so on. For medical gain, we've said that we allow self-endangerment. We pointed out already in a previous discussion that all medicine is risky. You take risks in order to benefit, and we do a risk-reward analysis, right? And we talked a little bit about the risk-reward analysis already in previous sessions. I don't want to take a lot of time on it, but if you take a look on the sheet, and I reposted the link for the sheet in the chat, so you should be able to get it. I gave you in source number 2 a link to a class of mine on using unproven medicine, where we talk about this issue of taking risk for medical gain at greater length. But take a look at source number 3, Rabbi Mordechai Halperin, writing in an article on heart transplants. And he says, you see, it's 1986 when he writes it, in normal surgeries, meaning not heart transplants, the patient is considered alive, meaning he has the ongoing status of alive the entire time. The patient comes in alive, but he enters a state of danger in the course of this normal surgery. So you'll say, well, how is he allowed to endanger himself by going into surgery? The answer is a patient may introduce himself into danger when the chances of healing are good. Right? That's what happens. You were intact. You go into surgery, you're not intact. But the odds are that at the end of the day, you're going to be intact again. So, we are good with that idea normally, But it's hard to apply that here. Because in our case, we have somebody who is perfectly healthy going in. They're not a candidate for surgery. Right? If they went into their doctor for a regular routine checkup that day, the doctor would say, you're in fine health. We're taking somebody who is in fine health. We're specifically looking for someone who is in fine health. And we're putting that patient in harm's way with an unpredictable illness. And not to mention, they may be in the placebo group. That's a scary thing. So we allow risk-taking for medical gain, but this kind of risk-taking? We also allow risk-taking, by the way, for non-medical gain. We talked about allowing risk-taking for the sake of people being able to earn a living, right? We said that in order to earn a living, you will be allowed to endanger yourself. So there is precedent for doing that. But again, not for taking risks that you don't need to take. Taking risks that you don't need to take is considered unjustified. Rabbi Meir Twersky, who is a Rebbe of mine, wrote an article about this earlier in COVID, back in May, June. This was at the time when there were a lot of demonstrations going on about lockdowns. And he made a very interesting point. In Judaism, we say, and I brought you an excerpt in source number 4, or my translation of his article. Hold on one second. You might make the following argument against lockdowns. You might say, since Judaism says you're allowed to take on risk for the sake of gain, I am allowed to take on risk in order to go to work. People don't want to, let them stay home. But I should be able to open my shop, I should be able to open my movie theater, or whatever it is, and let people come if they want to come, because people are allowed to take risks for the sake of a gain. Why is it that you're telling me I'm allowed to drive on Bathurst, I'm allowed to become a construction worker, but I'm not allowed to take risks during COVID? That was the question that people were asking, and that's the question that he addresses. If you take a look at source number 4, my translation of part of his article, he says it is true and correct that one may distinguish between a temporary threat and a threat which has taken root and created a new reality. And then in the Hebrew, he writes in Hebrew letters, new normal. So I put that in parentheses here. Where the threat is temporary, perhaps one is required to wait and hide until the wrath passes, the biblical verse. But where the threat has become embedded in the fabric of life, along the lines of the dangers of childbirth, for example, it is not possible to wait for it to pass. One definitely must live life while dealing with the threat. He says there's a difference between threats that you have to face and threats that you don't have to face. It's one thing to say, I need to take risks to be able to earn a living. I need to take risks in order to have children. Right? You take risks in order to enter other risks. It's legitimate to say that certain risks have to be taken. But if I don't have to, if I have the opportunity to wait, then there's no justification for doing so. And so I come back and say, once again, with the challenge trials will be a lot faster than trials in which you expose people in the community and then just see what happens, right? In other words, the main benefit of doing a challenge trial is speed. If I inject people with a vaccine and then say, go out in the community and we're going to reevaluate after a period of time has elapsed to see whether you are sick at the same rate as people in society or a placebo group, it takes months and months to be able to say, okay, there's a discernible difference, or there should have been a difference and there isn't one. Whereas if I'm actively exposing people, I can give you answers in weeks. Because we know that within a couple of weeks, one group should be sicker than the other, and if they're not, then the vaccine didn't work. So maybe I should look at this and say, number one, you're taking people who are perfectly healthy and you're exposing them to potential harm, and that's inappropriate. And number two, the speed doesn't justify taking a risk that could have been avoided. Avoidability is a big thing. So on that basis, I would say, if you stopped right now, no, you can't participate in the challenge trial. However,
Rabbi,
yes.
Wouldn't you argue that it's not just speed in itself, but speed saves lives?
Yes.
You can, in 2 months, find a vaccine that works versus waiting for a year. You're going to save, in 10 months, you're going to save people's lives.
Exactly. So Mark points out, as you just heard, that it's not just a matter of time. It's a matter of time and therefore saving lives. And that's where we go next. Because we have precedent in Judaism for justifying self-endangerment for the sake of others. As we already talked about last week when we said that taking a vaccine for yourself, even if you don't think you need it, will still help the community. And again, I reiterate what I said half an hour ago when we started, that this is so appropriate as a topic for Remembrance Day, this topic of endangering oneself to benefit others, because this is what we do. We save others and endanger ourselves to do so. Sometimes it's a matter of saving individuals who will help the community. So we talked about last week the idea of freeing terrorists in order to save soldiers who have been taken captive, because this is what we do. You need to, in order to justify the risks that the soldiers are taking. They talked about giving priority to healthcare workers who become infected. I gave you a case in source number 5 from the Jerusalem Talmud. There was a sage named Rabbi Isi who was taken captive. Rabbi Yonatan said, let the corpse be wrapped in its sheet. He said, it's done. Can't do anything about it. It's over. Reish Lakish, another sage, said, I will kill or I will be killed. I will go save him by force. Now, some of you may be aware, Reish Lakish's background includes a period of time as a bandit. So he's not coming to this without, as they say, a certain set of skills. But nonetheless, he's willing to endanger himself in order to be able to save Rabbi Isi. And then the story goes on and says, yeah, but he didn't actually use those skills. He went and appeased them. He found a way to make a deal, cut a deal, and get Rabbi Isi saved. But the commentaries look at this and say, what do you mean? How are you allowed to endanger your life to save somebody else? And one of the answers that's offered is Rabbi Isi was somebody of great value to the community. There are other passages that support this as well, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into it. But one point is that, yes, we have precedent in Judaism for justifying self-endangerment for the sake of others. Sometimes it is to save individuals of great value, and sometimes it's in order to save large numbers of people. So that last week we saw Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli make that point regarding going to war for the sake of the community. Individual soldiers will be harmed, and yet it's important for the sake of the community as a whole. If you take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach dealt with this issue of the military threat or the medical threat as justification for putting oneself in harm's way. Take a look at source number 6, please. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He's dealing with the question of medical trials. And he says, when the community is pursued by bears and lions, okay, bears and lions meaning a natural threat, and they need to fight them and chase them out, perhaps, aside from the fact this is considered life-saving, and therefore there's a mitzvah for each person to desecrate Shabbat and the like to save lives, perhaps it is also considered a mitzvah war. It's an obligation for the community to go out and do this in order to defend from the bears and lions. Not only is it a good thing to do, it's obligatory. So his analogy is that maybe it's obligatory to participate in a trial. And he says, although we lack a king or a court who could take the nation to war, still the town council could compel and endanger the lives of individuals as with war, even where an individual would not be obligated to save lives. In other words, even if an individual could say, well, I'm not supposed to put myself in harm's way, nonetheless, maybe the town council could say, yeah, you are. And if we're correct in this, then perhaps war against illnesses which lie in wait for people, like the bears and the lions, would be like a mitzvah war. Maybe we should view it that way. And it should even be compelled, he says. And if we would merit that all would be done according to the Torah, meaning the trials and everything else are going to be done according to the Torah, perhaps a court would see the need to test medicines as a mitzvah war of saving lives. Therefore, in our day, even though it is not done according to Torah, they're not necessarily running the trials on the advice of the rabbis. Still, since it is done via great experts with great care, logically there is no prohibition against volunteering for this. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's point is to say that just like in a war situation, we tell people to endanger themselves, even though regularly you would say don't enter such harm, so too here, he says, maybe it is justified, and even if it's not going to be compulsory, you should be able to volunteer for it. Even though we said you don't take healthy people and put them in harm's way, even for personal medical gain, and even though we said you avoid risks if they can be avoided, nonetheless, you're talking about saving lives. As Mark said, it's speed which will save lives. And therefore, in order to save large numbers of people or in order to save individuals who are valuable, we are willing to take such risks. And that brings me back. I'm sorry that I'm monologuing for a little bit. That takes me back to the point about the police and about the firefighters and those who put themselves in harm's way in a variety of ways, the EMS workers in a pandemic. Take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Usher Weiss, writing in Israel Today during Corona, said regarding trials. He says, it appears that this is so even in our case, that as long as it benefits the community, it is appropriate for a group of people whose heart moves them to volunteer for roles involving some danger. He approved of volunteering for such trials. Not compelling, but volunteering for such trials. And he noted what I brought you in source number 8. Source number 8 is the Shulchan Aruch, is the code of Jewish law. And it's talking about judges. And the problem of a publicly appointed judge who is dealing with a scary litigant. You have a litigant who is a threat to the judge. So the question is the judge able to say, I don't want to deal with this guy? I recuse myself. I'm not interested in endangering myself by sitting on this case. That's what they're dealing with in source number 8. And the key line for us is the line I bolded. If he is publicly appointed, it's not just like he's a rabbinic expert and people come to him privately. If he's a public appointee, he is obligated to deal with them. He doesn't have the ability to say, I don't want to deal with this guy. The community is considered to be, if you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, a leading authority in Jewish medical ethics, as well as, frankly, an authority in Torah in general, also a pediatric neurologist practicing in Israel today. So look what he has to say to explain why we put the community first. He says, the community and the collective are not only a collection of individuals, but an independent entity of its own nature and with its own rules and with the community's collective needs, sometimes even at the expense of the individual. And even though an individual is not nullified opposite the community, it's not as though the individual doesn't matter, still the community must make a special calculation of its own in different circumstances. This goes back to a point that I heard a couple of you make in the beginning when you were talking about why somebody would volunteer for this. He's putting it in terms of the power of the community to demand it of people and saying the community is not simply a bunch of individuals. It is a unit of greater value. And the greater the community, the more they matter. This is what we call in Hebrew, Hatzala Derabim, saving the multitudes. And so on that basis, rabbinic authorities will not make it compulsory to participate, but they will accept the idea of participating even in a challenge trial where you know that the placebo group has no protection other than the care they're going to get afterwards and the fact that they've been tested in advance to see that they're healthy. Nonetheless, they're willing to support it for the sake of the community. The obligatory Star Trek reference was just sent to me privately in the chat. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And there was a Jewish actor who indeed said that in the movie. So this is, I mean, it's not unique to Judaism, certainly. It's a broad idea. But it's something that Judaism takes very seriously and justifies. I want to come back, though, to a point that I made before, which is the informed consent point, which I mentioned in the beginning when we were talking about why or how we can justify such trials. And one of the things was, well, there's informed consent. Everybody involved from a secular ethical perspective and everybody involved from the perspective of halakha, of Jewish law, stressed the need for informed consent. But informed consent is not so simple. It's not straightforward. It's what you need in order to avoid it being coercion, frankly. But it's not simple. And I brought you three articles here, three pieces, in sources 10, 11, 12. But I'm going to say it outside in the interests of time. Number one, it's not so simple because patients are surrounded by factors which make it unlikely that their decision could be considered unbiased. And that's in that first article I brought you, Dr. Christopher Myers, Autonomy and Critical Care Decision Making. He challenges the idea that patients could actually have full comprehension. He's not talking about vaccine trials. He's talking about the patient was brought in because they having chest pain, right? They're scared. They have to make a decision quickly about what to do. The doctor runs through a set of options. They may have been sitting in the ER for 3 hours before they even got there, and they went through a whole bunch of tests. And now the doctor says to them, okay, here's what you can do. Here are the potential side effects. Here are the chances of success, and we can do this now. What do you say? Like, the patient is under such stress and is being exposed to things that they didn't know coming in. It's very difficult to imagine that a patient can be giving anything called informed consent in that environment. There are too many things that are making that too difficult. And I look at the list in number 10. He talks about power asymmetry, all sorts of different elements. Some of them we're going to come back to actually in the next item. It's so hard to think that a patient can actually do that. That's in a regular medical situation. That's not talking about the vaccine trial. The vaccine trial, you have more time to explain things, and there's less pressure. On the other hand, there are other factors that might get them to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do. They want the media attention. They want the respect of their love interest. They whatever it is, there are lots of reasons why people do things, and those reasons aren't necessarily the best. So I think that requires consideration as well. That's concern number one. Concern number two, I saw a couple of people who unmuted. I'm just going to go through the concerns here, and then we can take some comments and questions. Number two, though, anytime a medical authority presents an opinion, there's a concern for what we call diagnosis bias, meaning that the doctor's presentation is the background against which the patient forms an opinion. So take a look at number 11. I brought it there. And Christopher Myers makes the distinction between consent and assent. It's not really consent. It's really agreeing to what the doctor put forth as the best path. And therefore, there is inherently a bias for the patient. The patient forms an opinion based on what the doctor's already told them. Now, I don't mean that in order to undermine faith in the doctors. I like doctors. I'm not saying the doctor's a bad guy and the doctor's trying to get them to do something they shouldn't do. The whole reason the doctor's practicing medicine is to help people. But the point is that it's not really an independent decision that the patient is making. And then third, there's a natural assumption that you make as a patient, no one here should be in this situation. There's a natural assumption that people make when they are ill, that the medical establishment is going to protect them and look after their needs. It's just an assumption. They're going to be looking after me. When a physician is putting out a risky proposition, there's a voice in the patient's head that says, yeah, but they wouldn't do that if it was really dangerous. For sure, there's a net there to catch me. That's the way patients think. Speaking as somebody who has been a patient, that's the way patients think. They wouldn't expose me to that if it was really dangerous. I brought you in source number 12 from the Law Society of Ontario. From their rules of professional conduct, they talk about a situation in which a lawyer on one side is facing someone on the other side who is not represented. And the fear is that the self-represented party on the other side is going to assume that people are looking out for them and will protect them from the results of their errors. And that's not necessarily true. That's not necessarily their job. Sometimes it is their job. Meaning there are certain responsibilities of a lawyer who is dealing with an unrepresented party on the other side. But my point isn't that. My point isn't to discuss the law. That was a separate lecture that I gave a couple of years ago, and you can find it online. The point is that people assume that the medical establishment is there to help them and that they won't let them take unreasonable or inappropriate risks. So that the point that I'm trying to make here is that informed consent is not all it's cracked up to be. We require it, and we do the best we can for it, but don't kid yourself. There are biases involved, and it's not straightforward. Okay, I did a lot of monologuing in order to get to this point. I still want to talk about vaccine distribution triage at least a little bit, but on the other hand, I've done too much talking, so I'm going to open the floor for some questions and comments. Yes, Janine.
Yes. They don't really know what it's actually, you know, even if it's not death, there seem to be more long-term effects than the expenses. All the examples we've had is of someone participating and then who knows what will happen. This is someone choosing to infect someone with the virus.
Yeah.
I see a big difference that I can't get my head around.
But the trolley car dilemma is a good example if you realize it's not a choice between one person on one side and five people on the other side. It's all of society on the other side.
But you're making the decision.
But you're making the decision. The fact that the decision horrifies us doesn't mean it's wrong. You know, sometimes you're in a situation in which all your choices are bad, and the only question is, what's the least bad choice I can make? You know, there's a sentence that I keep on my computer. I'm going to shift screens for a second so I can read it to you out loud. From Shimon Peres. If you remember the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in the U.S., he actually he created what he called Rumsfeld's Rules. And this is one of them that he adopted for himself, in which Shimon Peres said, "If a problem has no solution, it may not be a problem, but a fact, not to be solved, but to be coped with over time." Leave aside your opinion of Perez's politics. That's not where I am right now. My point is, he's right. You may be dealing with a problem because you have a pandemic on your hands, and it's not a question of whether I like it or not. It's a question of, okay, but this is fact. That's a thing that's in my way, and now I need to figure out how I'm going to deal with it. It's, you know, it's shaping the decisions that society has to make. Sandy. The issue of avoiding risks which can be avoided?
Well, I thought in this case, you gave the example of the passing a law, not passing a law, but just that shocks people down. And the guy saying, well, I need to make a living. What's so harmful am I keeping my shop open?
No, what Rabbi Tversky was responding to there was the argument of, if Judaism allows me to take risks, for particular benefits. It allows me to drive to work knowing that driving is dangerous. Maybe I should be allowed, it's source number four on the sheet that she's talking about. Maybe I should also be allowed to open my shop, take the risk for myself, let the customers decide if they want to take the risks for themselves as well, in order that I should be able to make a living. That's the argument that people make. And Rabbi Twersky's response is, yes, it's true that there you can justify in certain cases taking risks for a particular benefit. And we talked about this in previous sessions, just making sure the risk you're taking is low and making sure that the benefit justifies that risk. But his point here is, even in a case like that, if you can avoid that risk, that's your duty. You don't have to take every risk that comes your way. I'm going to take questions, but I just want to note, I mentioned this in the beginning, we're going to be pausing at 11 for the moment of silence. And then I'm going to continue for a few minutes afterwards for those who can stay, and that's going to be when I'll discuss triage. For those who can remain, it will also be on the recording. So those who aren't able to stay will be able to catch it afterwards as well. There was going to be I saw a couple of hands, not sure whose at this point. Rose, you had unmuted, but you muted yourself again. I'll put it in the chat.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'll put the Shimon Peres' statement in the chat because it's a good one. There. Yeah, I don't know if that's his original wording, but that's in the article that I read. That was the wording. Okay. So that's all right. So other questions and comments on that, or I'll start framing the discussion about triage. Okay, we'll start on triage. Realistically, we can't deal with the full complexity of this issue in the short amount of time that we're going to spend on it, meaning there are all sorts of questions when you're dealing with triage and distribution of a vaccine. You know, if I have somebody who's lower priority in front of me to vaccinate, do I say, no, I'm going to wait because I only have a certain number of doses, so I'll wait for a higher priority person to walk in the door? If a vaccine needs to be administered in two doses spaced out over time, do I give it to a candidate? Do I give a candidate the first dose if I think this person isn't going to be responsible and isn't going to come back for the second dose? All sorts of complications. But I want to at least provide some sense of how Judaism does triage, drawing on sources which deal with triage for medical resources for people who are ill. Even though being ill and needing a vaccine are not the same case, nonetheless, there are three principles that I'd like to be able to articulate here. If you look on your sheet, in source 13, I referenced an article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of months ago on allocation of scarce medical resources. And they set out four values, all of which are consistent with values that are important in Judaism. Maximizing the benefits that can be provided by scarce resources. Make sure that you do the most good with it is one. You know what? It's 10:59. So I'm just going to pause there rather than speed read. We'll have the moment of silence, and then we'll, for those who are able to stay, we'll continue. So I'm just going to pause the recording. For those again who are able to stick around, we'll do a little bit of this vaccine triage, figuring out distribution. If you take a look at source number 13, that article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine said, previous proposals for allocation of resources in pandemics and other settings of absolute scarcity, including our own prior research and analysis, converge on four fundamental values. Maximizing the benefits produced by scarce resources is one. Okay, make sure that whatever you use is going to be effective. Treating people equally. Promoting and rewarding instrumental value. So in other words, if you have people who are healthcare workers, let's say, prioritize them. And giving priority to the worst off. Now, those are all principles that may conflict with each other. That's what makes these calculations interesting. But that's the basic idea. They're also hard to implement, even though, as I said, all of them make sense within Judaism. So, for example, treating people equally, meaning I'm not going to prioritize wealthy people, I'm not going to prioritize people with status. The question becomes, you prioritize just based on location of your distribution centers. You know, automatically, people are closer, they have a chance of getting a dose sooner. You prioritize based on how you convey information to the public. Those who have access to the means by which you're communicating the information are going to get it first. But it's a very important issue in Judaism. We have a principle when it comes to justice of mishpat echad yelachem. You have one law for everybody. We try to avoid prioritizing people based on their personal status. We have precedent for promoting and rewarding instrumental value to the community, right? Like we talked about in the story with Reish Lakish, trying to save Rabbi Isi, because Rabbi Isi's value to the community. Like, these make sense. What does Judaism want us to do? Two people come in simultaneously. How do I prioritize? And simultaneous is its own complicated thing. How do you define simultaneous? But not our discussion right now. So I just brought you some basic sources. Number one, we absolutely prioritize immediate need. If one party needs the vaccine now, let's say they live in an elder care facility, and there's a greater risk in a case like that, so they definitely should be prioritized. Rabbi Shmuel Wasner, a great authority in Israel, wrote this. If you take a look at source number 14, he says, it is obvious that if two patients arrive simultaneously, that's the case he's dealing with, and the situation of someone who is not of higher priority is worse, and he's in great danger, we must treat him first. Even though he's not a high-priority patient in other ways, he's not a healthcare worker, he's not a soldier, he's not somebody of instrumental value, nonetheless, you got to put this person first, and he says this is obvious. Immediate need is a major, major factor. Number two, effectiveness of treatment. If I have two patients in front of me, and one of them is likely to survive thanks to the treatment, and the other one is not, or is less likely to survive, I prioritize the one who is likely to survive. So Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, author of the Mishnah Berurah, said this regarding a fire. You go into the fire and you see two people. One of them is clearly very, very near death at that point, and the other one, you get him out of the fire, has a good chance of survival. So unfortunately, you have to prioritize the one who has a chance of surviving, as opposed to the other one who you're going to drag out, and then they're not going to make it. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein applied this in source number 16, dealing with the question of assigning beds in an ER. He said, regarding the case of two patients, one for whom doctors estimate that they can only provide short-term healing, extending life as much as possible, perhaps removing pain, but he needs immediate treatment. And the second, whom they estimate they can heal, they actually can heal this person, but they don't know whether he needs immediate care like that provided in the hospital's ER, and there's only one bed in the unit. So he said, and assuming they both come to you at the same time. So he says, it appears in my humble opinion that if both arrive simultaneously, meaning they have yet to bring either one in, neither one's gotten a bed yet, they must first bring in the one whom the doctors on scene believe they can heal. If there's even a possibility that they would need to begin his treatment immediately, you have to prioritize having an effect. So that effectiveness is of treatment. And then third, value to the community. This is controversial. Many sources are marshaled to support this perspective. I gave you the example before of saving Rabbi Isi. We've talked about it in terms of saving soldiers. However, Rabbi Usher Weiss was very against this, and I brought you a link, because this was in a presentation he made on video around the time of Passover. So I gave you a link, you can see the whole presentation there by Rabbi Weiss. Actually, it was April 6th, that was the day of the program. And he said, you can't prioritize based on value to the community, because you don't know what's coming next. Meaning, there's one person who has, yes, achieved a lot already. There's another person who, you save them now, and who knows what they go on to do. Every life is of equal potential value, and you can't say, this person is of greater value to the community. He was against it. So, to go to my review questions, four justifications for challenge trials. Number one, we do this in other areas. We endanger people, like the EMS workers and the firefighters. Consent, they're giving consent. They're likely to be exposed in the community anyway. And we minimize the risk of harm by using people who are as healthy as possible, and we give them great care. The ethical difference between regular trials and challenge trials. So in challenge trials, you're actively exposing them to the danger instead of letting them experience what they normally would have experienced. Huh, that was a much more succinct way to say it. It took me a lot longer the first time. If Judaism permits risk-taking for profit, would Judaism permit society to skip lockdowns in order to support the economy? And that was Rabbi Twersky's point, that the first of all, level of risk matters. You can't just take any risk. And also, if it's avoidable, then you have to avoid it, if it's avoidable. Three factors that undermine informed consent. So there are external factors that bias the candidate, the pressure they're under right now, what their spouse is saying, whatever. Doctors create diagnosis bias unintentionally, and patients assume that the medical establishment is going to protect them from any harm. And then last, what three Jewish approaches to triage did we identify? So we talked about immediate need, effectiveness of treatment, and potentially value to the community, although that one is difficult. So I'm going to stick around for a few minutes, but thank you very much for participating in the series. As much as one can say I enjoyed a topic like this, I enjoyed it. And I look forward to the Kabbalists of Tzfat in December. Please register if you haven't already done so. Okay, questions, comments?
I just want to say one thing about following the rules in the economy. I think that certainly under these circumstances where we're facing, we can definitely sustain a healthy economy by actually following the rules. Because if you socially distance, if you wear a mask, if you keep your hands clean, you will prevent further spread of the virus. You will do a lot for society, and you can still sustain the economy by not being in lockdown. The reason why we have lockdown is because we have put it upon ourselves. We have COVID fatigue, or we don't obey the rules, or 100 reasons, and that's why our economy is in distress. If we obey the rules and follow the science that we know and staying clear and staying away, that will sustain us, that will decrease the effect of this virus, the negative effect, and then we will able to sustain the economy.
So as much as I personally agree with what you're saying, I'm going to try to steer the conversation in different directions because, you know, in Jewish law, we have what's called halakha, the law, and mitziut, or mitzius, which is the reality of the situation in front of you. And a rabbi has to know that he can evaluate halakha, he can't evaluate mitziut. I have no special expertise, and I know that there are people who disagree with me. So I'm going to go away from that aspect of things and more towards questions that relate to the ethical issues that we're facing. But thank you. Susan.
I'm with you. What I have to have, this is personal, I guess.
You know what, do you want me to turn off the recording? So, okay.